history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, the stories are out there, and we'll never have the privilege of hearing them unless we take a little initiative, unless we ask a few questions and take the time to listen to what comes back our way. We get to do that for an hour on the radio each week, of course, but the hope is always that you're going to do it too, within your own circle. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we move in that direction, we always end up learning a lot. We're educated, we're entertained. So often, we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. With Thanksgiving approaching, I think of all the stories we've heard about the impromptu holiday meals in wartime, in the snow, in the tropics, in captivity. We've heard quite a few of those, but let's not forget Thanksgiving 2019 will find thousands of our men and women in uniform celebrating the holiday far, far away from those they love. There are a whole lot of ways that you can support them, but a really easy one is to sign the digital Thanksgiving card the USO has set up online. The goal was to have 100,000 patriotic Americans sign that card. And knowing this audience, I'm pretty sure we can surpass that. I have a link to that USO Thanksgiving card up for you on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And I trust that when you gather with your family this Thanksgiving, you're going to take some time to express gratitude for those who defend our freedom now and all those who've done so throughout our nation's history. We have the privilege of meeting some of them here on Hometown Heroes. Next time, we're going to introduce you to another Pearl Harbor survivor. But there are two veterans on my mind today, both centenarians, both known to friends and family as Bill. I just received word that Bill Gillette passed away this week at the age of 101. We met Bill earlier this year, a few months after he had celebrated the century mark, and one sentiment he expressed captured an idea that I think reverberates throughout all the conversations we've had with veterans on this program, underscoring just how far our world has come technologically, but reminding us that we're still not that far removed from so many pivotal eras in history.
When I was born, we did not have a car. I like to say that my dad courted my mother in a horse and buggy and lived to see a man walk on the moon. Those kind of things are amazing. I was farming with horses. We plowed until in 1942. I started training, and in 2 years, I'm flying a P-51 in war.
Bill Gillette flew 59 missions in World War II with the famed 4th Fighter Group, which destroyed more enemy aircraft than any other fighter group in the war. Some of Bill's 4th Fighter Group buddies called him G.I. Gillette because he'd originally been drafted into the infantry. We're so thankful for the privilege of meeting him and sharing his story, and our thoughts and prayers go out to Bill Gillette's family. I'm praying for Bill Barrett, too, but for different reasons. Bill Barrett has lived in Pueblo, Colorado since 1957, but he didn't start volunteering for the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum until 2010. We had the chance to meet him at that stellar museum in 2017, and I asked him why he decided to become a docent there.
Well, I was beginning to be a little bored staying at home, so I kind of looked around for something to do. I saw an ad in our local paper that they were needing help here at the museum. So I came out and talked to him, and I was hired to be a volunteer, and I've been here ever since.
And you spend most of your time in the gift shop,
I do, yes. I do not walk too well anymore, and there's a lot of walking to if you're a tour guide.
What are the big items in the gift shop that you see a lot of people snatching up?
We have a lot of toys for kids, a lot of airplanes, and a lot of our stuff goes to kids, especially if they're with Grandpa.
And you have two hangars worth of historic aircrafts here. Do you have a favorite? It's something that's on display at this museum?
Probably my favorite at the museum is the B-29 that we have here. We call it Peachy, and the reason it is called Peachy is that there was a young man from Pueblo that was a B-29 pilot. He had a sister he called Peachy. So when we got the aircraft here, we had to name it Peachy.
I guess you did, yeah. Does it look like the ones you saw in the Pacific during World War II?
Very much so.
And Pueblo has quite a history with World War II. This airstrip we're next to had some bombers flying off of it.
They trained the crews here for the B-24s, the B-29s, and the B-17s.
So the B-29 here is your favorite. Is there another one or two that you see a lot of people gravitating towards?
And different people like different planes. I like the A-26.
Yeah.
Real well. And my favorite plane during World War II was the P-38 Lightning.
Well, and you have a picture of yourself on the most famous P-38 Lightning that ever existed, and we're going to get that story from you before we're done here. But the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum is open 7 days a week. If you're lucky, you might run into Bill. What days are you here, Bill?
I'm on Wednesday, Saturday, and Sundays.
Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday. So plan your visit, Pueblo, Colorado, and come say hello to Bill, 97. He'll be 98 in November. Let's go back to your early days, though.
Okay.
Belleville, Kansas. What kind of place is that?
It's a small town in north central Kansas, just south of the Nebraska line. It's a farming community, not much industry there.
Did you grow up in a big family, small family?
No, I had two brothers older than I and one sister younger than I.
So what were those growing up years like for you?
You know, that's been a long time ago. And I don't remember an awful lot about my childhood.
You just don't want to tell me about the times you got in trouble? Is that what
you're saying? Well, I can't remember any of them.
Do you remember, Bill, having any ambitions, some hopes, some dreams, some, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this and this and this?
Not really. I just went with the flow.
Well, I guess you would have been out of high school a few years before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
That's
if you're
right.
97 now.
Yeah.
So what'd you do after high school?
I worked in the drugstore for a few years, and then I got a job as a drug salesman for a wholesale drug company in St. Joseph, Missouri. I traveled in north central Kansas and a small portion of Nebraska.
So you had a career going. You were moving on with life.
Right.
And you had a special someone in your life?
My girlfriend.
Lillian,
yeah.
How'd you two meet?
We knew each other in high school. I was a couple of years older than she. Actually, she worked in a little luncheonette there in town. I used to go over there and have a sandwich or something to eat once in a while and got acquainted with her and finally started going with her.
Yeah, so you're pretty sweet on her.
I was, yes.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
I was working at the drugstore that Sunday. When I got home, I didn't know anything about it at the store, but when I got home, the radio was on and was hearing about what had happened.
Was that pretty jarring?
Yes, it was.
Did you know where Pearl Harbor was?
Not exactly. I knew where Hawaii was, but I didn't know Pearl Harbor.
Had you ever even considered the prospect of war?
No.
Nothing?
No, I never did.
And now all of a sudden, the Japanese have attacked American territory.
Right.
So what'd you do about it?
The war started in December. In January, I went to Kansas City, Missouri, enlisted in the Army, signed some papers, talked to a number of people, and they sent me back home to quit my job and come back at a later date to be inducted.
Why'd you do that? Why did you want to get in the Army? You had a good job.
I just figured it had to do it.
Your country needed you.
Country needed it.
And you didn't want to wait to be drafted?
I didn't want to be drafted, yeah. I don't know how soon I would have been drafted. At that time, they had drawings for the draft. Everybody had a number, and then every once in a while they'd have a draft and draw out the different numbers.
Did you have an expectation of what you might be doing in the Army?
I had no idea. They didn't ask me what I wanted to do. I just wound up in the Signal Corps, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, and a lot of people these days aren't familiar with the Signal Corps. Or if they do ever hear the Signal Corps, it's maybe they see a photograph from 70 years ago, and it says U.S. Signal Corps at the bottom. So tell us about the Signal Corps.
They sent me from Kansas City to Jefferson Barracks in Missouri. I was just there for a few days, then I went to Camp Crowder, Missouri, which was an Army Signal Corps training center. The Signal Corps was the Army's way of communicating. Mm-hmm. They did it by radio, telephone, telegraph, in person, carrier pigeon. I don't think we ever used that in where I was, but they used motorcycles some and different types of ways to communicate.
But you probably also had to go through basic training too, right?
Basic training was more or less some of the Signal Corps things that you had to do. I knew how to type because I took typing in high school. I tried to learn the Morse code, but I didn't have the ear for those dots and dashes. Then I got some cryptography training when he was there at Camp Crowder.
Cryptography. So tell us what cryptography is.
Cryptography is the encoding and decoding of messages. From our signal center, every message that went out, every message that came in had to be in code. It was our job to put it into code or decode it and deliver the message to the proper authority.
Did it take you a while to get a handle for that?
Not too much. We had a machine that did a lot of it.
What was that machine called?
It was called SIGABA, S-I-G-A-B-A.
How big was it?
About the size of a teletype machine.
Today, people carry a little machine around in their hand called a smartphone that can outcompute just about anything. But, you know, spatially, how much space did that take
probably up? Probably as big as your laptop.
All right.
Yeah. Only it was complete, you know, it didn't have a frame that came up, or this that came up.
Big and thick and kind of heavy?
Yeah. It was. Oh, yeah, real heavy. Yeah.
So what could that machine do?
It encoded and decoded the machines for us.
So you could type in a message in plain English?
Right.
And it would turn it into a code?
Into a code. The way we got that code, the machine had 10 wheels on it.
Uh-huh.
And you had to set those wheels. The first five wheels we set every day at the same – the wheels had the 26 letters of the alphabet on it, each wheel. And then each morning or each at midnight, you had to set those – five wheels at a certain number, or letters.
Right.
That was given to us by a book we had that told us how to set it. And then on every message, the first 10 digits on the message that came in told us where to set the second wheel.
Okay.
And then you just typed your message and it either decoded or encoded.
So if you get one of those wheels off by one, the whole thing doesn't make any sense.
I don't know.
You never found out?
I never found out about that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So if everything has to be encoded, it means that the nature of these messages that are being transmitted must be fairly sensitive.
We had several different types of messages. We had the routine messages. We had priority messages. We had secret and top secret. But there was five different classifications of messages.
Did you feel a sense of responsibility or maybe even pressure to not mess this up?
Well, probably yes. I was the non-commissioned officer in charge of the signal center. After I made staff sergeant, they promoted me to in charge of the signal center. I didn't do a lot of coding and decoding after that. I more or less had to see that everything got done.
And were you hoping to head overseas, or would you have been just fine staying stateside?
I figured I would be sent overseas, yes.
And you went over pretty early.
Yes, I did. 6 months after I was in the service, I was sent overseas. September 1st.
September 1st, 1942.
We left the States.
Where'd you go?
Well, I tell people that I had a 29-day all-expense-paid cruise to Brisbane, Australia from San Francisco with a 3-day stopover in the Fiji Islands.
Sounds pretty luxurious, Bill.
Well, accommodations weren't like they are today on a cruise.
Had you ever been at sea before?
No, I had not.
I was going to say, young guy from Kansas, maybe a creek or a river's about as big as it gets.
I've been in a small boat.
Uh-huh.
Going fishing or something.
So you spend
a month
on a big old ship with a bunch of guys.
Yeah, right.
What was that like?
Very crowded. The food wasn't that great. Accommodations weren't that great. Down in the hole, there were about four decks of bunks that you had to sleep in. And it was hot and sticky down there. And we would sleep out on deck if the weather was decent and if you could find a spot to...
If nobody else beat you to it.
Beat you to it, yeah.
How about submarines? Was there a concern that you guys would be in danger?
I think there was because... when you're going overseas during the wartime, you zigzag.
Yeah.
And that's for submarine protection. And it takes longer going over than it does coming back when we came back because of the zigzag.
So you get to Australia.
Right.
And what's next?
Got off the ship. They took us up to a little town called Ipswich, Australia, where there was an army air base called Amberley Field. And I understand, I've talked to some people from Australia, Amberley Field is still there.
How about that?
Yeah. We spent about 3 months there, and we didn't do a lot. They had us out in the field about a half a mile away from the main camp, and we had to walk down there to our meals and stuff. We didn't do any communication until we got to New Guinea.
You know, and I'm always struck by this aspect of you guys who lived through this time, because we have the benefit of hindsight now. We can tell you, hey, December 7th, 1941 to mid-August 1945. That was World War II for America. But when you get over there in late 1942, how long did you think this was going to last? I mean, do you have any idea how long you're going to be out there?
I had no idea.
Did you think it might be over in a year or two?
Oh, no. No, we didn't. Knew it wasn't going to be over that soon.
You're in for the long haul.
Long haul, yep.
Did you think you might be in danger?
No.
No? Even though...
Not in our conditions, no. We had a lot of air raids, and that was all. I wasn't in the combat unit, and there wasn't any fighting close by. But we did have several air raids, and we actually lost some people in our unit in air raids.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's dangerous. Japanese bombers can kill you.
Yeah, that's true.
And before I get further with your experience in the Pacific, what about Lillian? What'd you say to her when you said goodbye?
I don't know.
Did you think you were going to come back and see her again?
Well, you never know. At that time, I didn't know what I was going to be in.
Mm-hmm.
However, when I was in Camp Crowder, my grandmother Barrett passed away, and I didn't get a three-day pass to go home to her funeral. It took me a day to get there. So right after the funeral, I had to go back to Kansas City, and then the next morning catch a train back to Camp Crowder. She did go back to Kansas City with me. She had a sister that lived in Kansas City. So we stayed there that night, and the next morning I had to say goodbye and never saw her again until November 45.
Wow. Did you get a few letters from her during that time?
I got a lot of letters from her, an awful lot of letters. I was unable to keep them. Had no way to do that, but she kept every letter that I wrote to her.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's how I wrote this, is from those letters.
You've got some of those letters. You put personal history together a few years ago.
Right.
While we're on that topic, here you are on the other side of the world from Kansas. What did it mean to you to get those letters from your girl?
Well, it meant an awful lot to get them from my girl and my family also. My folks wrote quite often. My sister wrote quite often. I didn't hear too much from my brothers, for they were both in the service also.
Yeah, where did they end up?
One of them was in infantry in France. My other one was in Germany, and he was in intelligence some way. He never did talk too much about it.
But all three of you came home?
All three of us came home. My oldest brother was in Normandy about 3 or 4 days after they invaded it. He did get injured and got some shrapnel in his leg. They sent him back to a hospital for a few days and then right back to the front.
Well, your family certainly made its contribution. Without question. So for you, you said 3 months there at Ipswich?
Then up to Port Moresby, New Guinea.
And he would spend the next year and a half there, which we'll hear about when we come back. If you want a spoiler on where this episode's headed, check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Let me just say that at the Pueblo Weisbrot Aircraft Museum in Pueblo, Colorado, they really love Bill Barrett. The museum also does a great job with its Facebook page, sharing veterans' news items and articles from all over, and that's definitely worth a follow if you're on that Facebook platform. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and here's something I realized this week. So often, this program is about looking back, looking way back into World War II with the men and women who experienced it firsthand. But every so often, we get to look forward with the veterans who share their stories here, and every once in a while, there's the opportunity to share an update. In the extreme cases, we're able to tell you about vets who reconnected with someone they'd wondered about for decades, or maybe they were finally awarded medals they earned long ago. Today, we're going to have an update to the story of Bill Barrett, who remains on the docent staff at the Pueblo Weisbrot Aircraft Museum in Pueblo, Colorado. Bill was one of three brothers who all served in World War II. 77 years ago, he was a 23-year-old Signal Corps communications expert heading to New Guinea.
December 5th of 42, we left Australia. Our company occupied the first hole of the ship, a makeshift ladder to go up and down, and we had to sleep on the floor. It took 6 days to reach our destination.
So then you get to New Guinea.
Right.
And you're going to spend the next year and a half there?
Yes, from December 42 to May of 44.
So you must have gotten used to it.
Oh, yeah. But I spent about three different areas.
Uh-huh.
We were at near Port Moresby, at Milne Bay, and at Ora Bay.
And what kind of work were you doing?
Communications. We were the first telephone exchange, American telephone exchange in New Guinea.
Can you give us a sense of the nature of these communications? Are you aware of what's being communicated all the time?
On some of them. We had to send a lot of reports back to headquarters at the end of the day. That's where it kept us busy most of the night. That's where we saved the routine messages for that communication that went back to headquarters. We knew some of the things that were going to happen during the war, maybe knew what was going to happen, but we didn't know exactly where or when.
Now you're talking about like invasions, islands?
Landings and stuff like that.
Yeah. Is that hard to think about when you know something like that's going to happen? I mean, do you think about those young men who are going to be crashing onto those beaches?
Oh, sure you do, yeah. You think about them, worry about them, and wonder how many of them's going to survive.
Yeah. And how about the role of communications in general? I mean, what would have happened if those messages that you're receiving and sending don't get through?
I don't know.
Probably would have cost some people some lives, right?
It could have, yeah. Yeah.
So this is an important job.
Yeah, it was really. And then before we end this, I would like to make a couple of comments on what some messages or some receipts we got about our that we did in the war.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, this is after I finished this book. This is how I ended it.
All right.
I was not wading the shore at Omaha Beach. I was not fighting the enemy across the fields and towns of France and Germany. I was not flying in an airplane bombing the cities of Europe, or flying a fighter plane escorting our bombers, or shooting down enemy planes. I was not fighting in the jungles of New Guinea, or storming a beach of some island in the South Pacific. I was not one of the 400,000 that never made it back home. However, the 912 Signal Company I was assigned to had a significant role in the war in the South Pacific.
All right. You then got us interested, Bill.
Yeah. And then here's something else that was written about us. I won't read this whole thing, but I'll read part of it.
All right.
The supply of the final equipment and the operation of communications for all the units of General George C. Kennedy's 5th Air Force in New Guinea was the mission of the 912 Signal Company. In conjunction with the 27th Air Depot Group, the organization was awarded the Presidential Unit Citation for Outstanding Merited Service and Achievement during the Papuan Campaign. The model signal depot established by the 912 Signal Company at Port Moresby has become the criterion upon which all other Signal Corps units of the Far East Air Force have been set up. From the 13th of December 1942 to 25th of April 1945, when the unit left Port Moresby to set up a signal depot in the Netherlands New Indies, the 912 Signal Company has played a significant part in turning back the Japanese and in hoping to help make the eventual doom of the Japanese Empire.
So they said, you guys are the standard.
Yeah.
Your
right.
signal company. That's how they want them all to work.
That's right.
So what are some of these messages that you guys are transmitting that were so important that led them to write that about you?
Well, we had a few secret messages. Never did have a top secret message. Being we belonged to the 27th Air Depot Group, their primary purpose was to getting airplanes back into flying. After, of course, they had to build all their buildings and everything because we went into a valley they called Death Valley is where we were set up.
Mm-hmm.
It was right across the hill from the airstrip, Ward's Drome, and which I understand Ward's Drome is still there also.
Huh.
The message we mostly sent was like, take one of the units that worked on airplanes, and at the end of the day they had to report on what progress they made and how soon that aircraft was going to be back flying condition.
Mm-hmm.
And then every unit more or less had to send back something they their report for the day to back to MacArthur headquarters in Australia. And that was a part of our job to do that.
Speaking of MacArthur,
yeah.
I understand you got somewhat close to him on at least one occasion.
I got a picture of him, but never got very close. They wouldn't let us get close to him. But
where was that?
It was in New Guinea at Port Moresby the day he came up to decorate Bong for his achievement.
Ah, well, we're going to have to tell the Dick Bong story then. Before we get to that, you did mention, and you downplayed it, but for most of us, Bill, we haven't lived through an air raid. We haven't been on a military base and heard the warning and tried to figure out how in the world you're going to stay safe when you have no idea if these bombs are going to land anywhere near you.
Right.
How frequent was that you guys would have an air raid?
Well, I don't know how frequent, but they went on for about 8 months before they stopped.
And how do you know it's happening?
You usually hear a siren. We would be over the hill from the airstrip. We'd hear sirens, and then the lights would go on, the searchlights. And then eventually you could see it. When they pick up the planes, you could see the planes up in the air.
So this is nighttime.
Nighttime, yeah.
The planes are coming. The searchlights are going off. And where are you?
In a pup tent.
In a puppy.
Well, at first. The very first night we got into Port Moresby, we had an air raid.
Very first night.
Very first night.
Welcome to Port Moresby,
yeah.
Bill.
Yeah. So all we could do was just stand there and look.
And
we,
what do you see?
We had set up our pup. Well, you see the planes in the searchlights.
And you see bombs coming out of the planes?
You couldn't see them, no, but you could hear them after they hit.
How close did they hit to where you were?
Just over the hill at the airstrip.
Uh-huh.
One night later on, a plane did sneak in behind one of our airplanes and drop some bombs, and one of them landed in a theater area. And it just happened that the movie had been over for a few minutes, so there were a few kids still hanging around, and some of them were killed. In fact, we lost three kids in from our outfit that night.
From your company?
From our company, yeah.
And a couple things here. So if it had been 5 minutes earlier, you would have lost a lot.
Lost a lot of people, yeah.
Were you in the theater?
No, I did not go that night.
Did you usually go?
I went to a lot of theaters because that's about the only thing there was to do at night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why
and
didn't you go that night?
I have no idea. I might have been working.
It's
okay,
possible, sure.
It's possible I could have been working that night.
And the young men who were killed, did you know any of them?
I know all three of them because they were in my communications.
So you'd spent quite a lot of time with these guys.
Oh, yeah.
How hard was that for you to deal with?
It was pretty hard to miss them. Especially one of them in particular was a very intelligent gentleman, very nice gentleman, and had a lot of stories to tell. And he was really a character, and we really enjoyed, everybody enjoyed him, and we really missed him.
Did that kind of change the tenor of your company after that?
I don't think so, no.
Did you ever feel like, well, maybe that could happen to me too?
Oh, it's possible, very possible, yeah.
Were you prepared for that?
Well, you take it as it came. If you got hit, you got hit.
So obviously that was the closest.
That was the closest I ever came in. Usually we were it was probably a couple of miles over to the airstrip. That's where they had most of their bombing range was on the airstrip. And it just happened this one night, this Japanese plane came in under the radar following one of our planes in, and he hit one of the warehouses, and I think he dropped three bombs, one of in the warehouse, one was in just a little area, and then this one that landed in the theater area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so you lost three guys, and on a lesser note, you probably didn't have any movies to watch for a while.
Well, there's several movie places around the area.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you want to go to a bunch of you want to go to a movie, you go to the motor pool, and they'd give you a truck to go to the movies.
And so, you also got to see a few movie stars out there.
I did see a few movie stars, yeah.
You guys had a few USO crews come through,
yeah,
or what?
Yeah, USO crews, yeah.
Tell me about it. What were those like?
Interesting, funny. We saw Joey Brown, who was the funniest guy you ever saw. I don't know how many people remember Joey Brown, but he was a very good comedian, and I think that's the hardest I ever laughed the night that we had him. It was funny. I don't know whether you know anything about Joey Brown, but he had a big mouth.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Joey Brown did, and a lot came out of that big mouth.
A lot of GI humor there, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
And Jack Benny came
through?
Saw
Jack Benny, Gary Cooper, John Wayne, Bob Hope, and there's probably some more I can't recall.
Yeah, well, those are some pretty big names.
Yeah, big names, yeah.
What did that mean to you to have these big names from Hollywood coming all the way to the other side of the world to be there for you guys?
Well, you really appreciate that, what they went through to do that. A lot of them went through some air raids and stuff like that too to put on these shows for us.
Sure. You said the air raid thing again, so I'm just wondering. I don't think I asked you this. Were you ever scared over there?
Oh, yeah, sure. When they start dropping those bombs, you never know where they're going to go.
And I imagine, too, in the messages that you're receiving and sending out, the nature of some of those messages had to do with casualties and losses. Did you have a sense of how the war was going?
Pretty much so. Being in communications, you knew we could get news out of Australia and stuff like that.
So you knew that momentum was heading in the right direction?
Yes.
And when I asked you about MacArthur, you brought up the name Bong. I'm sure a lot of your visitors here at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum know who Dick Bong was.
A lot of them don't.
Well, you get to educate them then, right?
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of them about it and showed them the pictures that I have. Yeah.
So tell me how this all developed. You guys were actually sending the message that the record for the most aerial victories had been broken?
No, we knew, I forget how, but we do know that he broke this record.
Yeah, so Dick Bong was a P-38 pilot in the Pacific.
Right.
And the record for kills in aerial combat was held for a long time by Eddie Rickenbacker
in
from
World War One. World War One, yeah.
But Bong ends up breaking it in his P-38.
Yeah, by shooting down 27 enemy planes. Rickenbacker did 26.
So Bong gets his 27th.
Right.
You guys hear about it.
Right. And so a couple of days later, some of my friends and I went over to the airstrip to see if we could find his plane, and we were lucky enough to find it. And I happened to have my camera with me. I got a picture of his plane, the whole plane. I got a picture of the 27 flags painted on the side of the fuselage. Mm-hmm. And then I have a picture of me and one of my buddies sitting on the wing of his plane.
It's a great picture. I'm going to put that up at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I wonder how many people have a picture like that, Bill.
Not very many, I don't think. Yeah. On the plane, yeah.
Did you have to ask anybody's permission?
No, there wasn't anybody there but the three of us.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, wasn't anybody around the plane at all that day.
And he wasn't done.
Oh, no, he ended up doing 40.
How amazing is that?
Yeah, that's amazing, yeah.
So he breaks the record, and then MacArthur's coming to Port Moresby to congratulate him.
To congratulate him, yeah.
And you were there.
I was there. Well, this was the same day that we were saw the plane.
Uh-huh.
And around one of the, they call them a revetment? Uh-huh. Revetment, yeah. There was a bunch of people standing, and one of the guys come over and talked to us. He must have been one of the photographer or reporters or something. He said, if you guys want to stick around a while, they'll make with your time. But they wouldn't let us get very close.
Uh-huh.
In fact, we kind of had to set up on the top of the revetment. And pretty soon the plane came in, and MacArthur came out of it. And I did get a picture of him. But so far away, you couldn't hardly tell who it was, except he was a little bit taller than everybody else. And somehow I lost that picture. I don't know what happened to it.
But you still have the memory.
I still have the memory of seeing him, yeah.
And that must have been kind of exciting.
It was, yes. Sure was.
But you left there in mid-1944.
Right.
Where'd you go?
Biak Island.
Tell us about that.
Biak Island is a small island off the coast of New Guinea. I don't know how far. Took us a few days to get up there on another ship. There, our camp was right next to the air. There was the airstrip. Road and then our camp.
Uh-huh.
So we saw a lot of planes coming and going. And
did you ever talk your way into a ride on any of those planes?
Never. Well, I'll take that back. I had one furlough to Australia and begged to ride on a C-47 down. Coming back, we went out to the airport to see when it was time to go back to, this is to New Guinea, got a ride on a Catalina, which is a boat that lands on water or
so. Yeah.
Or land, and I was hoping we'd land on water, but they didn't. Yeah. And I also got to ride on a PT boat.
What was the occasion for that?
Off the island of Biak, there was a PT boat installation, and a friend of mine that I knew back in Kansas was a pharmacist mate over there. And he came over to Biak once in a while, picked up supplies and stuff, and I got to know him, that he was there. And he came by once or twice to see me when he came into town. So one night, I took time off and went and rode over with him and stayed all night with him and rode back the next morning, both times on a PT boat.
Were you ready to drop some depth charges?
No. Pretty fast, though.
Yeah, they were.
It went pretty fast, yeah.
And what about the living conditions on Biak? Was that different compared to
about the same. We were in tents all the time. Eventually, we got lighting and flooring in them. Mostly, part of the time, they just had a dirt floor. We were never in the barracks all the time I was overseas.
Never in the barracks?
Never in the barracks.
More than 3 years over
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
So why don't you live in a cabin in the woods or something, Bill?
Well, I like it in town too well.
Uh-huh. And, talk to a lot of guys who experienced those conditions. A lot of them ended up with tropical diseases, malaria, other things.
Yeah.
Did you ever have any issues with that?
Well, no, I never had, but they made us take a malaria pill every day.
Uh-huh.
When you went through the chow line, there was a guy at the end of the chow line that gave you a malaria pill, and he made just sure that you took it.
What would you say was the hardest thing to deal with over there?
Probably being away from home.
Especially when things happen at home that you can't do anything about. 16 million Americans were away from home serving our country all over the world in World War II. There are fewer than 400,000 of them still living today. And in Colorado, that number is under 6,000. But 100-year-old Bill Barrett is one of them. You'll hear more of his World War II memories, plus an update on why this month was so special for him when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, featuring a man who just celebrated a milestone moment in the home of heroes. If you've ever been to Pueblo, Colorado, you know that's the label, the home of heroes, that proud city of 110,000 carries. That moniker originated in the fact that four men from Pueblo have all been awarded our nation's highest military decoration, the Medal of Honor. You'll find statues of those four men outside the convention center in Pueblo, one from World War II, two from the Korean War, and one from the Vietnam War. And you'll also discover the names of every American who's ever earned the Medal of Honor, more than 3,400 names engraved in a powerful monument there. It is more than worth a little detour off of Interstate 25, and while you're in Pueblo, you can experience the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum, where Bill Barrett volunteered to be a docent 9 years ago. You'll find Bill's smiling face all over the museum's Facebook feed, and we'll elaborate a little more on that in a moment. But first, let's wrap up Bill's time with the Signal Corps in the Pacific during World War II.
Off the coast of Okinawa, there was a little town or a little island called Aishima.
Yeah.
Where Ernie Pyle was killed.
Exactly.
I went by the spot where he was killed. And later on in the years, my wife and I were in Hawaii, and I went into the punch bowl, and his horse went by where he was buried. A very prominent correspondent during World War II. Now, the reason I went to Okinawa, our company, the Signal Company, repaired radar equipment for different units. Whenever it was repaired, they had to have somebody go with it to see it got to the proper place.
Uh-huh.
And I did take one of those trips. That's when I got into the Philippines and up to Okinawa and on Aishima.
Did you have a sense that the war was drawing to an end?
Oh, we knew it was over. In fact, the day I left Okinawa to go back to my unit, General MacArthur flew out of the same airstrip that I was at to go sign the peace treaty.
Well, speaking of other milestone moments, you know, I see a note here in the journal that you kept about finding out that President Roosevelt had died. Was that a message that you guys had come to your station?
Yes, yeah.
How did that hit you?
Pretty hard. He did a lot during the war for the communities and the country and the states, and I'm glad they kept him on all during the war instead of changing during the war.
I'm sure you had heard him on the radio on December 8th.
Huh? Oh, yeah.
And again, looking at the notes that you've put together, July of 1945, you've got a note here. It says, "The last letter from home informed me that both my mom and dad were in the hospital. I did not know what was wrong with my mom, but dad had been hurt helping someone move a piano. I didn't hear another word for 2 weeks." How hard was that?
It was pretty rough. But I knew something had happened to one of them. Because I didn't hear anymore.
So
my girlfriends quit writing to me, family quit writing to me. And the reason they did, because the guy that was in charge of the Red Cross there said, "Oh, he'll get to come home. All we have to do is let him know he'll get to come home." So don't, but I didn't.
You didn't get to come home.
Didn't get to come home.
And after all that waiting on pins and needles and that hopeless feeling of not knowing and having no way to find out, you finally got really bad news.
I got the news from a chaplain that called one night and wanted to talk to me. He wouldn't tell me anything over the phone. So I went to see him, and he told me that my mother had passed away. But it was no big surprise because I knew something had happened to one of them.
You'd prepared yourself for
that. I kind of prepared for it, yeah. But it was tough coming home and not having my mother there.
Oh, I imagine.
Yeah.
And here, you've been out there for 3 years in the Pacific, living in a tent.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some of the summers must have just been really brutally hot.
Hot and rainy seasons and stuff. Then. Yeah.
It's not a very comfortable existence.
Oh, no, no.
And the same week that Japan surrenders and there's so much to celebrate, you get this horrible news that your mother has died.
Yeah, she passed away on August 5th, and I think the war was over about that same time, if I remember right.
About 10 days later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they knew that it was coming to an end at that time back in the States.
Was there some celebration out where you were when you guys got that news that Japan had surrendered?
Quite a bit. A lot of guys were shooting off their guns and had fire. I don't know where they got fireworks, but some of them had fireworks and stuff. I have no idea where they came from. Mostly with guns going off and guys hollering, and both when Japan surrendered and when Germany surrendered. Same thing.
How excited were you to come home?
Really excited. You'll never know how excited you are to get it. Discharged and get to come home and see your family and your girlfriend. That was the highlight of my Army career, I think.
Well, tell me about that moment. How did that all unfold?
I have a discharge in Denver, and I came home on Rock Island Rocket, which is a train that came through my hometown. And my dad and my little sister, my girlfriend, and I don't know, 8 or 10, 12 of my friends are all there to greet me. It was a great time to see all of them and get to hug my girlfriend and get a kiss her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys didn't have that experience.
That's true. A lot of them never came home.
Some, even if they did, 3 years is a long time to wait for a boyfriend.
Well, that's true. A lot of them got Dear John letters.
I'm sure there were some guys in Belleville that had eyes on Lillian.
Well, yeah, I'm sure of that.
So how long did you wait to pop the question?
I'm not sure how soon we talked about it, but we were married less than a month later.
Less than a month after you got home?
We were married on December 2nd.
Wow. Yeah. And when'd you get home?
November the 8th.
November the 8th.
Discharged the 7th and got home on the 8th.
You know, talking about dates, if you're over there in the Pacific living out of tents for more than 3 years, you spent a lot of holidays over there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What's it like to spend a Christmas or a Thanksgiving out there in the tropics?
They usually had a good meal for us on Christmas, Thanksgiving. You had turkey and all the dressings. You know, that's about it.
Make you pretty homesick?
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
When Christmas rolls around now, you ever think about those Christmases you spent out there?
Not too much. I don't think a lot about my time in the service.
So you wait all of a month to get married to Lillian after she's waited for you to get home for 3 years. You guys go on to have a couple sons. You've got a couple granddaughters. You ever think about what if? What if you were in the theater that night? What if you were one of those more than 406,000 Americans who didn't come home?
Yeah. What if I never made it home? Well, there wouldn't be two great boys, two great granddaughters.
Yeah. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, makes me feel pretty proud of all my family. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And thankful you came home.
Thankful I came home, and my sons both done real well. They've retired from big companies and got good pensions and stuff and doing real well.
And you told me one of your sons worked for NASA for decades and is still in that Washington, D.C. area. Have you been back to Washington and the National World War II Memorial?
Oh, yes. I got on that honor flight.
Uh-huh.
That they have. Are you familiar with that?
Very.
Okay. I went with that with my brother. He and I went together.
You and your brother got to go together.
On the honor flight out of Denver.
How much trouble did you guys cause?
I don't know. He was in a wheelchair most of the time. He was getting along. He was 2 years older than I was.
Tell me about that experience. What'd you get out of it?
Oh, it's a great experience for me, especially being with him. Meant a lot to me, seeing it together.
And I know you tend to downplay your time in the war, even though you were overseas a lot longer than most World War II veterans.
That's true, yeah.
Did that honor flight experience, the way people treated you in D.C., the way they treated you back here in Colorado when you came back, did that give you a new perspective on what you had done and what it meant to people?
Well, not really. You know, I feel what I did was necessary. It had to be done. But I feel sorry for all those guys that were in the infantry and fighting and all that kind of stuff. And with what they did and what I did, I don't think I did too much. That's my feelings.
Well, I've heard a lot of guys say that to me. But but the rest of us know that we wouldn't be here without you.
Yeah, that's
Your
true.
Sons wouldn't have been born, for sure, if you didn't come home.
Yeah.
The world would be a much different place.
That's true.
If you hadn't done what you did.
Yeah.
That memorial itself, when you look at all those gold stars,
what
comes to mind? What'd you think about when you were looking at that?
Well, you feel sorry for them that didn't make it back home.
Were there any moments of that trip back to D.C. that kind of stand out for you that were real impressive or meant something to you?
Yes. They had Europe on one side, the Pacific on the other side, and they had the one named New Guinea.
Uh-huh.
And I spent a lot of time in New Guinea, so I got down beside it and had my son take a picture of me with the New Guinean right beside me. That might have been one of my highlights.
I bet when you're here in this gift shop, you get some opportunities to talk to people who certainly weren't alive when World War II was happening.
Right, yeah.
What's the most important thing that you think people need to know about what happened, about the young men and women that served our country during that time?
Well, I think they need to think about the people that never made it back home. They need to think about the people that served. That's about it.
What would you say that you're most proud of, Bill?
During my service?
In life in general, sure.
Oh, well, being married and having my family.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But during the war, I think probably what we did, the communication that we did for the service, probably the most important thing I did.
Were there ever nights over there in the Pacific where you're sitting in that tent and you're wondering, am I ever going to see Lillian again?
Yeah, you never knew. You could get hit, like I say, get hit in an air raid or have an accident of some kind and not make it.
And this one's out of left field. I've had a lot of guys talk about this, and I've heard every end of the spectrum. Some guys really feel like God was protecting them. Others, hey, it was just luck. I made it back. You have a strong opinion on that one way or the other?
Luck. I'm not a real good churchgoer. I go with my kids once, a few times, but one reason I kind of got out of it when I was working back in Kansas, calling on drugstores, the three drugstores in my hometown wanted me to call on them on Sundays. I kind of just got out of the habit of going to church at that time and never really got back into it too much. That's my fault.
Did you ever hear Tokyo Rose when you were over there?
Oh, yeah.
What do you remember about that? What kind of stuff did she say?
The streets were, Port Moresby were running with Yankee blood. And,
and you knew that wasn't true.
I knew that wasn't true. That's the main thing I remember that she was talking about,
So that just give you a chuckle? Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story and helping us understand a segment of the war that a lot of people aren't familiar with, what the Signal Corps did. Just one last thing. You spent 38 months out there in the Pacific. You don't know if you're going to make it home. You don't know if you're going to experience America again. What kind of perspective did that give you on what America stands for or what's valuable about our country?
It's just our flag. We fly it here every day at the museum.
It looks like it's well protected out there, too.
Yeah, pretty much so.
There's pretty big guns sitting right in front of it.
Right in front of it.
Is there anything else about the museum you want to say?
One thing we do have out there in the museum is some what they call an instrument of surrender, some documents that were signed by the Japanese and Americans on the Marizuru in Tokyo Bay.
Yeah.
That's out there. And also a couple of pens that were used to write those signatures. And they got some stuff. They say it's MacArthur's pipe and his cap is out there.
Of course, I don't live here in Pueblo. You've lived here for the last 60 years. Do you ever get the sense that this museum is kind of a hidden secret or a hidden jewel that some people don't know about?
A lot of people from Pueblo come out here and say, I never knew this place was out here.
How long do you plan on continuing this, to come in here on Wednesdays and Saturdays and Sundays and volunteering your time?
I plan on having my 100th birthday party here.
So that is what Bill Barrett said 2.5 years ago in April of 2017. The next month, he returned to his native Kansas for his 80th high school reunion. He was the only member of the class of 1937 there. But this month, his plans of celebrating his 100th birthday at the Pueblo Wise Broad Aircraft Museum came to fruition. A fall that left him with a broken bone has him temporarily out of the docent rotation at the museum, but he was there in a wheelchair to commemorate the century mark. His sons say he's already planning birthday number 105, and even the local news cameras were there to capture the moment.
I'm 100 years old, yes, sir.
At hometownheroesradio.com or on Facebook under Hometown Heroes Radio, you can find TV and print articles about Bill's milestone moment. His resilient spirit rubs off pretty quickly on those who have the privilege of rubbing elbows with him. Happy belated birthday, Bill. It is great to see a plan come together. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today. Until next time, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.